Chapter 6. Scintilla City. I've seen 75 years come and go, said Caspar Hauser, and I've worked 50 years on this project.
And the Prix d'Aumale attests to the sterling...
Could I finish? Could I... Henrik Slusen nodded and made a conciliatory gesture with his gloved hand. Hauser swallowed. His mouth was dry.
I have worked for 50 years, he resumed, shepherding the concept of the conservatory from nothing into this form. I was raised by a man who understood the value of information, of the preservation of learning.
That's something we all believe in, Dr. Hauser, said one of the 36 rubricators, sitting in a semicircle in the writing desks behind Slusen. Hauser had asked Vasily to arrange the meeting in the college's Innominium Theatre, the lecture theatre panelled in brown wood, rather than the provost's office, as Slusen had requested. A psychological ploy. He could get Slusen and his entourage to take the fold-down seats built for students and diminish them in contrast to his authority.
I believe the doctor was still a little way from finishing, Vasily told the rubricator.
His tone was smooth, but there was unmistakable chastisement in his voice. Vasily was standing at Hauser's left shoulder. Hauser could tell that his mediary had one hand inside his coat pocket, secretly holding on to the small vial of medication in case the tension of the situation became too much for Hauser. The man worried too much. It was charming.
The work the conservatory has done, said Hauser, the work I have done, it has all been about expanding mankind's understanding of the cosmos. It has not been about salvaging data and placing it in an inaccessible archive.
Explain to me how you think that is happening, Doctor? Asked Slusen.
Explain to me the process by which any average citizen can access information from the administratum data stacks under secretary, Hauser replied.
There is a protocol. A request is made.
It requires approvals. Authorities.
A positive request may take years to fill. A refusal may not be explained or appealed. Information assets, precious information assets, are being placed into the same vast pot as general global administrative data. Vasily, current assessments made by the Office of Efficiency predict that the centralized data wealth of the Imperium is doubling every 8 months. Simply navigating a catalogue of that data wealth will soon be arduous. In a year or two...
Slusen did not look at Hauser's mediary.
So it's a problem of access and of the architecture of our archives. These are issues that I'm happy to explore.
I don't believe they are issues, Undersecretary, said Hauser. I believe they are symptoms and excuses. They are soft ways of censoring and forbidding. They are subtle ways of controlling data and deciding who gets to know what.
That's quite a claim, said Slusen, entirely without tone.
It's not the worst thing I'm going to claim today by any means, Undersecretary, said Hauser, so hold on tight. High-level control of global information, that's bad enough. A conspiracy, if you will, that restricts and seeks to govern the free sharing of composited knowledge throughout mankind, that's bad enough. But what's worse is the implication of ignorance.
What?
Asked Slusen. Hauser looked up at the ceiling of the lecture hall, where egg-tempera angels flew and cavorted through gesso clouds. He was feeling a little light-headed, truth be told.
Ignorance, he repeated. The Imperium is so anxious to retain proprietorial control of all data, it is simply stockpiling everything without evaluation or examination. We are owning data without learning it. We don't know what we know.
There are issues of security, said one of the rubricators.
I understand that, Hauser snapped. I'm simply asking for some transparency. Perhaps an analytical forum to review data as it comes in, to assess it.
It's 6 months since Emmentine put you in charge, Undersecretary. 6 months since you began to steer the conservatory into the dense fog of the administratum. We are losing our rigour. We are no longer processing or questioning.
I think you're exaggerating, said Slusen.
Just this week alone, said Hauser, taking the data slate Vasily held out to him, 189 major archaeological or ethnological survey reports were filed directly to the administratum through your office without going through the conservatory. 96 of those had been directly funded by us.
Slusen said nothing.
Many years ago, said Hauser. "So many years ago it alarms me to count them. I asked someone a question. In many respects, it was the question that led us to this place, the question that drives the whole ethos of the conservatory. It comes in two parts, and I'd be very interested to know if you can answer either."
"Go on," said Slusen.
Hauser fixed him with an intense stare. "Does anyone even know why the Age of Strife happened? How did we end up in the great darkness of old night to begin with?"
"What are you going to do?"
asked Vasily. "Finish packing," Hauser replied. "Perhaps you'd like to help."
"You can't leave."
"I can."
"You can't resign."
"I did. You were there. I expressed a desire to Under-Secretary Slusen to withdraw from the project for the time being. A sabbatical, I think it's called."
"Where are you going to go?"
"Caliban, perhaps. An investigative mission has been sent to audit the great and fearsome bestiaries in the Bastion libraries. The idea appeals. Or Mars. I have a standing invitation to study at the Symposia Adeptus. Somewhere challenging. Somewhere interesting."
"This is just an overreaction," said Vasily.
The afternoon sunlight was piercing the mesh shutters of the high hive dwelling, an academic's quarters, fully furnished, generous. The items in the room that were actually Hauser's belongings were few, and he was hurling them into his modular luggage. He packed some clothes, some favourite data slates, and paper books. His regicide board.
"The Under-Secretary's answer was just flippant," said Vasily. "Trite. He didn't mean anything by it. It was a politician's nonsense, and I'm sure he'll take it back on reflection."
"He said it didn't matter," said Hauser. He stopped what he was doing and looked at his mediary for a moment. He was holding a small toy horse made of wood, deciding whether to pack it or not. He'd owned it for a long time. "He said it didn't matter, Vasily. The causes of the Age of Strife were of no consequence to this new golden age. I have never heard such folly."
"It was certainly hubristic," said Vasily.
Hauser let a thin smile cross his lips. His leg ached, as it always did in times of stress. He put the wooden horse back on a side shelf. He didn't need it. "I'm going," he said. "It's been too long since I did any field work, far too long. I'm sick to the eye teeth of this bean counting and political fancy work. I'm not made for it. There is no part of me that ever wanted to be a bureaucrat. You understand that, Vasily? No part. It disagrees with me. I need to work in a marked trench or a library with a trowel or a notebook or a picter. I'll only be gone a short while, a few years at most. Enough time to clear my head and refresh my perspective." Vasily shook his head.
"I know I'm not going to talk you out of this," he said. "I know that look, the one you've got in your eye. It says, stay away from the crazy man."
Hauser smiled.
"There, you see? You know the omens to look for. You've been warned."
The Quietude's homeworld, that neon orange ball, was actually skinned with ice in the parts that mattered. The Quietude, it appeared, had artificially extended its ice caps like an armoured sheath. A message was sent to Ogvai asking for further expertise.
"We're going to the surface," Fifth Godsmote said to Hauser. "You'll come. Make an account."
It almost sounded like a question, but it was really a statement of the imminent. Stormbirds had been brought into the Graving Dock's extravagant facilities. As the men of Trar readied their weapons and kit and lined up to board, Hauser saw that some of them were engaged in half-joking arguments.
"What's going on?" he asked Godsmote.
"They're debating which bird you should ride on," said Godsmote. "When you came to Fenris, you were a bad star, and you fell out of the sky. No one wants to ride down the sky with a bad star."
"I can imagine," said Hauser. He looked at the Astartes and called out, "Witchcraft is bear travelling on." Some of the men pointed.
"That one, then," said Hauser, walking towards the vehicle. "Bear won't let me fall out of the sky. Twice."
The men of Trar laughed, all except Bear. The laughter was edged with wet leopard growls. Hauser had to wear a plastic rebreather over his nose and mouth because there was something in the atmosphere that didn't agree with standard human biology. The Astartes had no need of support. Many went bareheaded. The view was extraordinary. The sky, only faintly bruised by vapour, was an oceanic amber canopy that had such bright clarity it looked like blown glass. Everything had a slightly yellow cast to it, an orange tinge. It reminded Hauser of something, and it took him a little while to pull up the memory. When he finally did, it was surprisingly sharp. Ossetia, a few days before his 40th birthday. Captain Vasily sniggering as she allowed him to try on her heavyweight headgear. Him blinking as he peered out through the giant slide visor at a world tinted orange. Then he heard in his head the March of Unity being played on an old clavier, and tried to think about something else. They had sat down on a great ice field. Under the orange sky, the landscape was flat, but dimpled, like a textured flooring fabricated and rolled out from a machine. It was ice, though. The dimples were where small liquid ripples had flash frozen, and punch samples had been taken by the engineer corps of the advancing Imperial Army brigades. The chemical composition matched those derived from orbital scanning. Stupendous towers the size of Hive City spire caps, but of a design ethic that matched the graving dock far above, protruded from the ice field at regular intervals of approximately 670 kilometres, like cloves studding a pomander. Almost the first thing the wolf beside Hauser said was, "There's no hunting here." He meant the ice was sterile. Hauser could sense it too. This was not the absolute white wilderness of Azaheim. This was an engineered landscape. The towers were generators, in his estimation. In the face of a massive extraplanetary invasion, the Olamic quietude had used its appreciable technology to extend its natural ice caps to form shields. The thickness and composition were such that great parts of the orbital bombardment had been reflected or resisted. There were cities under the ice where the quietude was preparing its counterattack. The Imperial Army had targeted some of the towers and were attacking them in vast numbers. Hauser saw tides of men and armoured fighting machines washing in across the ice towards one, pouring in across pylon bridges and support struts. Mass gunfire had stippled the ice field, and the crust around the tower structure was beginning to melt, suggesting that damage had been done to parts of its mechanism. There were fires burning everywhere. Thousands of threads of dirty smoke rose into the ochre sky across the giant vista, each one spewing from a destroyed machine, just dots on the ice in the general mass of attackers. It was a scale that he could not really comprehend, like the scenic backdrop of some painting of a general or war master with a raised sword and his boot on a fallen helm. Hauser had always presumed the apocalyptic battle scenes rendered behind them were somewhat over-enthusiastic, and largely intended to fluff the sitter's importance. But this was bigger than anything he had ever seen. A battlefield the size of a continent, an armed host that numbered millions, and that host only one of hundreds of thousands that the Imperium had birthed upon the awakening cosmos. In one repellent moment, he saw the contradictory scales of mankind, the giant stature that allowed the species preeminence in the galaxy, and the individual stature of a great-coated trooper, one of scores, falling and lost under the charging boots of his comrades as they stormed the alien gates. Quietude defences lashed the advancing lines with withering disdain. Along the leading edge of the attack, the air seemed to distort as the quietude's weapon effects impacted and mangled armour, ice, and human bodies. High on the ominous tower, massive lamp-like turrets rotated slowly and projected down beams of annihilating energy, washing them slowly as they turned like the beacons of fatal lighthouses. The beams left black, steaming, sticky scars gouged through the densely packed hosts of advancing Imperials. Super-heavy tanks in deep formation braced for ice firing and began to devastate the lower flanks of the tower. Parts of it blew out, ejecting huge sprays of debris. The explosions looked small from a distance, and the clouds of debris little more than exhalations of dust, but Hauser knew it was simply scale at work again. The tower was immense. The cloudbursts of debris were akin to those that might rain down after the destruction of a city block. As he watched, a whole bridge section collapsed, spilling Imperial soldiers into the gulf between the tower and the ice shelf it was plugging. Hundreds of soldiers fell, tumbling, tiny, the sunlight catching braid and armour. Several armoured vehicles plunged with them, sliding off the bridge section as it caved, tracks snapping and lashing. They had been assaulting one of the main exterior gates, which had remained shut and unyielding throughout. Another bridge section collapsed about 5 minutes later when one of the tower's sub-turrets succumbed to bombardment from the super-heavy tanks and slumped like a landslip, its form unforming, its structure blurring, its weight ripping down off the face of the main tower and exploding the massive bridge into the gulf. How many thousand Imperial lives went in that second, Hauser wondered, in that flash, in that senseless roar? What am I doing here?
Come on, you scald, come on.
He turned from his ringside view of Armageddon and saw the flame-lit face of Bear. There was no smile or expression of regard to be found there. Hauser had learned this to be a character mark of the sullen wolf. He presumed that Bear was particularly sullen with him because he, a human, had caused Bear, an Astartes, embarrassing problems in the eyes of his company, and the Vilka Fenric as a whole. Where? Hauser asked. Bear bristled slightly.
Where I tell you, he said.
He turned and tilted his head to indicate that Hauser should follow. They left the powdery yellow lip of an ice ridge where most of Trar had settled to observe the assault. Behind them, an expanding column of thick cream dust was slowly filling the amber sky. It was emerging from the tumult surrounding the tower assault, climbing into the sky like a stained glacier, ponderous and threatening. The upper parts, where it broadened, were already 70 kilometres across, and the formations of army gunships and ground attack craft lining up on the tower were having to fly instruments only as they penetrated the sulphurous pall. Hauser followed Bear up the slope. The fine yellow powder ice was adhering to the wolf's dark, almost matte grey armour. Sometimes Hauser stumbled or slipped a little as the soft slope trickled or subsided under him, but every single step Bear took was sure. Deep strides, planting his massive armour-shod feet, not once having to steady himself with a hand. He began to leave Hauser behind. Hauser fixated on the black leather braids and runic totems tied to the wolf's belt and carapace, imagined himself grabbing hold of them and clinging on, and tried to catch up. They wound up the cliff slope, through groups of lounging wolves, past the brooding Terminator monsters, their gross armour burnished and glinting in the sun, past teams of thralls making adjustments and spot repairs to seams and joints as their masters waited impatiently to go back and view the battle. The Terminators were as immobile and sinister as cast bronze sculptures, all arranged to face the nearby conflagration. Away from the unmarked but defined perimeter of Tra's vantage point, the rear echelon and supply encampments of the Imperial Army Group were spread out like a souk. There was a dead space, a fringe of about 2 kilometres, between Tra's position and the closest army post, indicating the intense reluctance of any soldier, officer, or even mediary of the Imperial Army to come within sight of a Fenrisian wolf. If they only knew, Hauser thought, there are no wolves on Fenris.
"Keep up,"
Bear said, turning to glance back. Now at last there was an expression on his face. It was annoyance. His black hair made a ragged curtain that threw his eyes into shadow and made them shine with nocturnal malevolence. Hauser was dripping with sweat under his bodysuit and the pelt draped over his shoulders. He was out of breath, and the sun was burning his neck. "I'm coming," he said. He wiped perspiration off his face and took a long suck from the water straw that fed into his rebreather mask. He stopped deliberately to catch his breath. He was interested to see how far he could push Bear. He was interested to see what Bear would do. He hoped it wouldn't be hit him. Bear watched. He'd braided his jet-black hair around his brow and temples before the attack on the graving dock to afford and cushion the fit of his Mark IV helm. One of the braids had worked loose and was causing the curtain across his eyes. Bear began to plait it back into place, waiting for Hauser. Hauser took another deep breath, flexed his neck in the prickling heat, and caught up. They entered the army encampment. It had only been there a few hours, but it was already the size of a large colony town. Arvus and Aves pattern transatmospheric lifters were still coming in and out to make drops in a haze of ice vapour on the far edge. The vapour was catching the sun and creating partial rainbows. The encampment, a patchwork of prefab tents and enviro modules mixed with pods, containers, payload crates and vehicles, some beige, some gold, some khaki, some russet, some grey, looked to Hauser like a patch of mould or lichen spreading out across the clean surface of the ice field. When he mentioned it later, this description also won him some approval from the wolves. No one challenged their entry into the encampment. Around the edges of the mobile base were pickets of Savarine Harriers with their shakos and gold-topped staves, and G9K Division Kiloliters wearing long dusters over semi-powered combat suits. Not a single gun twitched in their direction. As the wolf approached with a human bumbling along behind him, the soldiers found other, far more important things to look at. In the streets of the tent town, the bustling military personnel gave them a wide berth. It was like a souk, a busy market, except all the traders were provisioners of military service, and all the produce was munitions and materiel. "Where are we going?" Hauser asked. Bear didn't reply. He just kept striding on through the camp. "Hey!" Hauser shouted and ran to catch up. He reached out and pulled at the thick, blunt edge of Bear's left armour cuff. The ceramite was numbingly cold. Bear stopped and very slowly turned. He looked at Hauser. Then he looked down at the vulnerable human hand, touching his arm. "That was a bad idea, wasn't it?" said Hauser, removing his hand warily. "Why don't you like me?" he asked. Bear turned away and started walking again.
"I have no opinion either way," said Bear, "but I do not think you should be here."
"Here?"
"With the rout."
Bear stopped again and looked back at him.
"Why did you come to Fenris?"
he asked. "That's a good question," said Hauser.
"What's the answer?"
Hauser shrugged. Bear turned and started walking again.
"The Jarl wants you to see something," he said.
Close to the centre of the vast encampment, which was feeling more and more like a carnival ground to Hauser, a large command shelter had been erected. There were tented shades overhead to screen off the harshest of the ice desert's hard sunlight, and walls of reinforced shockboarding to baffle any stray or lucky munition strike. Nearby, a crew of polished silver servitors laboured to install and activate a portable void shield generator that would, by nightfall, be protecting the high-value section of the encampment under a fizzling blue parasol. The tent shades and shockboarding distorted the travelling roar of the conflict on the other side of the ridge and somehow made it louder and more intrusive than it had been on the slope where the wolves had gathered. A crowd of perhaps 200 had gathered under the central awning. They were surrounding a mobile strategium desk, the top of which was alight with active and moving hololithic displays. The crowd, all Imperial Army officers, parted to let Hauser and his towering Astartes escort through. As he stepped up onto the self-levelling interlock staging, Hauser felt a pop in his ears and a chill on his face that announced he had just entered an artificial environment bubble. He unclasped his rebreather and let the mask dangle around his neck. He smelled clean air and the body sweat of hot, agitated, tired men. Ogvai was at the centre of the crowd, beside the strategium desk. He was not escorted by any of Tra, and he had removed his helm and some of the significant parts of his arm, shoulder and torso plating. Hugely armoured from the gut down, he stood with his long white arms emerging from the rubberized black of his sleeveless underlayer with its feeder pipes and heat soaks like necrotized capillaries, and his long black centre-parted hair resembling a wage-about pit-fighter ringed by an audience at a country fair. As a child at the commune, Hauser had seen men of that kind many times. Rector Juve had sometimes taken the children to the festivals at the work camps of Ur, where, in sight of the slowly forming monolithic plan of the city dream, the labour force would halt to celebrate the periodic feasts of Cathamas, Radmastide, and the Divine Architect, as well as the observances of the builder lodges. These holidays were basically excuses for spirited fairs and jubilees. Some of the larger labourers would strip to the waist and invite all comers to bouts of sparring for beer, coins, and the crowd's entertainment. They would tower head and shoulders above the onlookers, too. Except here, the onlookers were army service personnel, many of them large and imposing men. Ogvai was a raw-boned monster in their midst. With his skin so white, he looked like he was carved out of ice and immune to the merciless heat, where they were all ruddy and sweating. The fat silver piercing in his lower lip made him look like he was taunting them all. Why has he stripped back his armour, Hauser wondered. He looks informal. Why does he want me here? Bear stopped at the edge of the ring of onlookers, with Hauser behind him. Ogvai saw them. He was in discussion with three senior army officers around the desk. He leaned forwards, resting his palms on the edge of the desk and his weight straight-armed on his hands. It was casual and rather scornful. The officers looked uncomfortable. One was a field marshal of the Outremars, obediently holding up the holographic visage of his telepresent Khedive master, like a waiter holding a Grox's head on a platter. Beside him was a thick-set, choleric G9K Division Kill combat master in a flak coat and a quilted tank driver's cap. The third was a freckled, pale-blonde man in the austere uniform of the Jagdpanzer regiments. It was curious to hear Ogvai speaking in low Gothic, curious to know that he could, curious to hear his jaw and dentition manage the brittle human noises.
"We are wasting time," he was saying. "This assault is not punching hard enough."
The hololithic image of the Outremar Khedive squealed in outrage, a sound distorted by the digital relay.
"That is a frank and open insult to the architects of this planetary attack," the image declared. "You exceed yourself, Jarl."
"I do not," Ogvai corrected pleasantly.
"Your comment was certainly critical of the competency of this assault," said the Jagdpanzer officer in a tone rather more conciliatory than the one the Khedive had adopted, probably because he was actually standing in Ogvai's presence.
"It was," Ogvai agreed. "This is not punching hard enough for you?"
asked the G9K commander, making a general gesture at the display in front of them.
"No," said Ogvai. "It's all very well as mass surface drops go. I guess one of you planned it."
"I had the honour of rationalising the invasion scheme on behalf of the expedition commander," said the Khedive.
Ogvai nodded. He looked at the Jagdpanzer officer.
"Can you kill a man with a rifle?"
he asked.
"Of course," said the man.
"Can you kill a man with a spade?"
Ogvai asked. The man frowned.
"Yes," he replied.
Ogvai looked at the G9K man.
"You. Can you dig a hole with a spade?"
"Of course,"
the man answered.
"Can you dig a hole with a rifle?"
The man didn't reply.
"You've got to use the right tool for the right job," said Ogvai. "You've got a big, well-supported army and a world to take. It doesn't automatically follow that throwing the former at the latter will get you what you want."
Ogvai looked over at Bear.
"Like you wouldn't try to hunt an Urdak otter with an axe, eh, Bear?"
Bear laughed a wet leopard growl.
"Yolda, no. You'd need a long tooth spear to get through the fur."
Ogvai looked at the army commanders.
"The right tool for the job, see?" "And are you the right tool?"
the Khedive asked. Hauser heard the Jagdpanzer officer gasp and recoil slightly.
"Don't push it," Ogvai said to the hologram. "I'm trying to help you save a little face here. It's you the fleet commander is going to drag over the coals if this situation doesn't start to improve."
"We are grateful for any advice the Astartes can offer," the field marshal carrying the hololithic plate suddenly said, holding the platter to one side in case his distant holoform represented master said anything else provocative.
"That's why we sent the request to you," said the G9K man.
Ogvai nodded.
"Well, we all serve the great Emperor of Terra, don't we?"
he said, flashing a smile that showed teeth.
"We all fight on the same side for the same goals. He made the wolves of Fenris to break the foes that couldn't otherwise be broken, so you don't have to ask twice, or even that politely."
Ogvai looked at the projected, slightly shimmering face of the Khedive.
"Though a little basic respect is always good," he said. "I want to be clear, mind. If you want us to do this, don't get in the way. Go back to your superiors and make sure they send official communiques to the commander of the expedition fleet that my Astartes have been given theatre control to end this war. I'm not moving until I get that confirmed."
Why did he want me to see that? Hauser wondered. Does he want me to be impressed? Is that it? He wants me to see him intimidate and bully senior and serious Crusade commanders, and he wants them to see he can do it stripped to the waist like he's relaxing. The meeting began to disperse. Ogvai wandered towards Bear and Hauser.
You see? He asked in Uvic.
See what? Hauser replied.
What I brought you here to see, snapped Bear.
That everyone fears you? Asked Hauser. Ogvai grinned.
That, yes. But also that I abide by the codes of war. We abide by the codes of war. The Vilka Fenrika abide by the codes of rule.
Why is it important to you that I understand that?
The Sixth Legion Astartes has a reputation, said Bear.
All the legions Astartes have reputations, replied Hauser.
Not like ours, said Ogvai. We are known for our ferocity. We are thought to be feral and undisciplined. Even brother legions consider us to be wild and bestial.
And you're not? Asked Hauser.
If we need to be, said Ogvai. But if that was our natural state, we'd all be dead by now.
He leaned down towards Hauser like a parent addressing a child.
It takes a vast amount of self-control to be this dangerous, he said.
Hauser requested permission to stay in the army encampment for an hour or two more until it was time to depart. Ogvai had already wandered off. Bear gave Hauser a small Homer wand and told him to return to the drop site the moment it chimed. It had been a long time since Hauser had been around regular humans, a lifetime in which he had been reborn as something that was not entirely human any more. After waking, he'd lived in the fastness of the Fang with a rout for the best part of a great year, acclimatizing, learning their customs, learning their stories, learning his way around the gloomy vaults of the Eight. In all that time, three things had been kept from him. The first was the person of the Wolf King. Hauser didn't even know if the Sixth Primarch was actually on Fenris during that period. He doubted it. The Wolf King was more likely up, leading companies in the service of the Emperor. Hauser reconciled himself to the fact that Skarsen and Ogvai would be the most senior wolves he would have access to. The second thing was a secret, something about Hauser himself. It was hard to say how Hauser knew this, but he did. It was a gut response, an instinct. Wolves often described to him particular moments in combat in such terms. Visceral stimuli felt in their living bowels that made the split-second difference between living and dying. They always sounded proud of being sensitive to them. Hauser flattered himself that his immersion in their society was teaching him to recognize the same trick. If it was, then it was telling him something. The Astartes and their thralls were withholding some details from him, one thing in particular. It was an intensely subtle thing. There were no crass signs like conversations abruptly halting when he entered rooms, or sentences suddenly trailing off when the speaker thought better of them. The third thing was Imperial Human Company. Towards the end of his first great year, Deck Company returned to the Eight from a long tour of service in the Second Cobalt War, and Tra found itself rotated into the line with instructions to shadow and support the 40th Expedition Fleet in the Gog-Magog cluster. There never seemed any question that Hauser, as Scald, would go with them. He was part of their portage, part of company support, along with the thralls, the armourers, the pilots, the servitors, the musicians, the victuallers and the butchers. They embarked onto Nidhoggur, one of the grim, comfortless warships that served the Sixth Legion, and made the translation to the Immaterium with a flotilla of service tenders in support. 9 weeks later, at a Mandeville point shy of Gog-Magog Beta, they retranslated and made contact with the 40th Expedition Fleet, which was by then pressing fruitlessly into Alamic Quietude territory.
"What sort of thing are you?"
Hauser looked up from the strategium desk and found he was being addressed by the G9K Division Kill Combat Master who had been in conference with Ogvai.
"Do you have clearance to be here?"
the man asked, clearly emboldened now that the brute Astartes had gone.
"You know I do,"
Hauser replied, with a confidence that surprised even him. The man was prepared to argue the toss, so Hauser brushed back his hair, which had grown long during the great years spent at the Eight, and properly revealed his gold and black-pinned eye. I am a watcher, chosen by the favour of the 6th Legion Astartes, said Hauser. The combat master's expression registered distaste.
But you're human.
Generally speaking.
How can you live with those beasts?
Well, I watch my tongue for a start. What's your name?
Powell Corrin, Combat Master First Class.
I get the distinct impression that no one here is comfortable having the wolves as allies. Corrin studied Hauser, uncertainly.
I'll watch my tongue, I think, he said. I don't want them looking at me through your eyes and deciding I need to be taught a lesson in obedience.
It doesn't work like that, Hauser smiled. I can be discreet and selective. I'd like to know what you think.
So you're some kind of what? Chronicler? Remembrancer?
Something like that, said Hauser. I make accounts. Corrin sighed. He was a heavy-set man with Prussian ethnic traits, and he carried himself with the manner of a career soldier. G9K had a considerable reputation as a frontline force. It famously maintained an archaic performance-based pay and advancement model that was said to have its origins in the pre-diluvian traditions of mercantile-sponsored mercenaries. For Corrin to have achieved the post of Combat Master First Class, he had certainly seen some considerable active service.
Tell me what you meant, said Hauser. Corrin shrugged. I've witnessed plenty, he said. I know that old soldier routine, but trust me, 37 years non-adjusted, that's what I've spent in this crusade. 37 years, 8 campaigns, I know what ugly looks like. I've seen Astartes fight 4 times. Every time, it scared me.
They're designed to be scary. They wouldn't be effective if they weren't. Corrin didn't look especially convinced.
Well, that's a whole different issue, he replied. I say if man's going to take back this great imperium, he ought to do it by the sweat of his brow and the strength of his arm, and not build damned supermen to do the work for him.
I've heard that line of argument before. It has some merit, but we couldn't even unify Terra without the Astartes to...
Yes, yes. And what will we do when the work is done? Corrin asked. When the crusade is over, what will we do with the almighty space marines? What do you do with something that can only ever be a weapon when the war is over?
Maybe there will always be war, said Hauser. Corrin crinkled his thin lips distastefully.
Then we really are all wasting our lives, he replied.
His wrist-mounted communicator, thickly cushioned in black rubber, beeped, and he checked the display.
6-hour evacuation has just been posted, said Corrin. I have to see what's going on. You can walk with me if you wish.
They went out, back into the open and the roasting sunlight. Hauser felt the artificial atmosphere sleeve pop around him and replaced his rebreather. Activity levels in the camp had risen. Out in the rainbowed band of vapour beyond the camp edge, lifter craft were queuing out across the ice desert in a wavering, hovering line as they waited their turn to swing in and load up. The distant ones crinkled in an eerie heat haze.
You don't approve of Astartes, then, Combat Master? Hauser asked as they strode through the camp.
Not at all. Extraordinary things. Like I said, I've seen them fight 4 times.
They entered the Combat Master's command post, a large enviro-tent where dozens of G9K officers and technicians were already dismantling the site for withdrawal. Corrin went to a small desk and began to sort through his personal equipment.
The Death Guard once, he said, holding up a finger to begin a tally. Murderous efficiency with such small numbers. Blood angels,
another raised finger.
A firefight gone bad in a Cassian works on one of the Framium moons. They arrived like angels. I don't mean to be glib. They saved us. It was like they were coming to save our souls.
Corrin looked at Hauser. He raised a third finger.
White scars, side by side, for 6 months on the plains of X-173 Plural, housing xenophorms. Total focus and dedication, merciless. I cannot, hand on heart, fault their duty, devotion to the crusade cause, or their supreme effort as warriors.
You said 4 times, Hauser pressed.
I did, said Corrin.
He raised a fourth finger in a gesture that reminded Hauser of surrender.
The space wolves
2 years ago, non-adjusted. Deck Company, they called themselves. They came in to support our actions during the cobalt scrap. I'd heard stories. We'd all heard stories.
What kind of stories?
That there are space marines and there are space marines. That there are supermen and there are monsters. That in order to breed the Astartes perfection, the Emperor who guides us all has gone too far once or twice and made things he should not have made. Things that should have been stillborn or drowned in a sec.
Feral things? Asked Hauser.
The worst of them all are the space wolves, replied Corinne. They were animals, great terror. They were animals, those things that fought with us.
When you have sympathy with the enemy, you know you have the wrong kind of allies. They killed everything and destroyed everything, and worst of all, they took great relish in the apocalypse they had brought down upon their foe. There was nothing admirable about them, nothing rousing. They just left a sick taste in their mouth, as if by calling on their help we had somehow demeaned ourselves in an effort to win. Corinne paused and turned to hand out instructions to some of his men. They were obedient, well-drilled, attentive. Hauser could see that Corinne was a soldier who expected an army to be supremely disciplined in order to function. One of his men, a burly second-classer with a chin-strap beard, brought a data slate over for Corinne's review. He glared belligerently at Hauser. Corinne handed the data slate back to his officer.
"Full withdrawal from the surface," he said.
He sounded broken.
"All forces.
We're to stand down and get clear so the wolves can take it on alone."
"Shit. This assault has cost us thousands of men, and we're just scrapping it."
"Better that than thousands more." Corinne sat down, opened a haversack, and pulled out a slightly battered metal flask. He poured a generous measure into the cap and passed it to Hauser, and then took a swig from the flask.
"When the 40th discovered that the wolves were the only Astartes in range who could help us tackle the Quietude, we almost cancelled the request. I heard that as a fact from one of the senior men close to the fleet commander. It was a genuine consideration that we didn't want to involve ourselves with the wolves again.
You'd rather face defeat?"
"It's about ends and the means that get you there," Corinne replied. "It's about contemplating the question, what are the wolves for? Why did the Emperor make them like that? What purpose could he possibly have for something so inhuman?"
"Do you have answers to any of those questions, Combat Master Corinne?" asked Hauser.
"Either the Emperor is not as perfect an architect of this new age as we like to suppose, and he is capable of manufacturing nightmares, or he has anticipated threats we cannot possibly imagine.
Which would you prefer?"
"Neither notion fills me with great confidence about the future," replied Corinne.
"Do you have an answer, as you keep their company?"
"I don't," said Hauser. He'd finished his drink, and Corinne refilled the cap. It was a strong spirit, an Amasek or a Schnapps, and there was a flush on Corinne's cheeks, but Hauser felt nothing except the slightest burn in his throat. Life on Fenris had evidently bred a stronger constitution into him.
"The things we fought in Cobalt space," said Corinne quietly, "they were lethal and proud. They had no interest in human ways or human business, and they were quite capable of fighting us to a standstill. They had mighty vessels like cities. I saw one of them. I was part of an assault against it. Someone called it Scintilla City because it sparkled like it was all made of glass. We later found out it was called Thuyelsa in their language, and it was a structure they called a craft world. Anyway, we never worked out why they were fighting us or what they were trying to defend, except perhaps that they were trying to keep us at bay or keep for themselves whatever it was they had. But you just knew inside yourself, they had something worth defending. A legacy, a history, a culture.
And it was all lost."
Corinne looked down into his flask, as if some truth might lurk inside in the dark. Hauser suspected he might have been looking in that very same place for an answer for quite some time.
"At the end,"
Corinne said. They began to plead. The wolves were upon them, and the city vessel was shattering around them, and they realized that they were going to lose everything. They began to plead for terms, as if anything was better than losing everything. We never really understood what they were trying to tell us, or what kind of surrender they were trying to make. I personally believe that they would have given all of their lives if Scintilla City had been allowed to survive. But it was too late. The wolves couldn't be called off. They sacked it. The wolves destroyed it all. There wasn't even anything left for us to salvage. No treasure for us to plunder. Nothing of value to claim as a prize. The wolves destroyed it all. Corinne fell silent. The Homer wand Bear had given to Hauser gave out a little beep. Hauser set the cap down and nodded to the combat master. Thank you for the drink and the conversation. Corinne shrugged. I think perhaps you malign the wolves a little, Hauser added. It may be that they are misunderstood. Corinne made a sound, possibly a laugh. Isn't that what all monsters say? He asked. Hauser left the G9K enviro tent. All around him, personnel were busy dismantling the encampment for surface departure. He stood for a moment, consulting the Homer's direction indicator. Behind his back, someone cursed him. He swung round. Corinne's second-classer, the man with a chin strap, and several other G9Kers were loading impact-resistant crates onto a flatbed truck. "Did you speak to me?" Hauser asked. Chinstrap's glare was toxic. He set down the crate end he had been lifting and walked towards Hauser. His men looked on.
"Sack of shit, animal!" Chinstrap hissed.
"What?"
"Go back to the filth you run with. You should be ashamed. They're not human. They're animals."
Hauser turned aside. The man was big and aggressive, and he was evidently upset. It was the sort of confrontation Hauser had sought to avoid for most of his life. Chinstrap grabbed Hauser's right arm. The grip was painful.
"You tell them that," he said. 1,700 men division kills lost in one day of surface assault, and now those stupid animals tell us to piss off. 1,700 lives wasted!"
"You're clearly upset," said Hauser. "This has been a costly engagement, and I am sympathetic to—"
"Screw you!"
The other men, the members of Chinstrap's loading team, had closed in. "Let go of my arm," said Hauser.
"Or what?"
Chinstrap asked. "Run," Mirza told him. Mirza was usually right about these things. It wasn't that Mirza was a coward, Hauser supposed. It was simply because he was far more the rationalist. After all, neither of them were fighters. They were academics, field archaeologists, average men with above-average minds. Neither of them had any military schooling, and neither had been on any kind of self-defense training program. They were armed only with their wits and their accreditation papers, which stated their names, the fact that they had both recently celebrated their 30th birthdays, and their status as conservators working in Lutetia for the Unification Council. None of which was going to do them very much good.
"They can't be allowed to get away with this," Hauser began.
"Oh, just run, you idiot!"
Mirza shouted back. The other members of the placement team were already running, no further encouragement needed. Their boots were clattering down the cobbled back alley as they scattered into the warren of unmapped streets crisscrossing the slum quarters of Lutetia around the dead cathedral. The cathedral was just a giant corpse building. It had died as a place of worship during the 19th War of Uropan's succession 3,000 years earlier, and since then its structure had been put to other uses. A parliament hall for 3 centuries, a mausoleum, an iceworks, an almshouse, and latterly a market when the last of the roof fell in. For the last 800 or so years it had been an empty husk, a physicalized memory, lifting its rusting iron ribs at the overcast sky. The rumours of its past had persisted as long as those ribs, if not longer. Mirza had not been able to keep the excitement out of his voice when he'd briefed the team 2 days before. The site had been a place of worship for as long as records existed, and the cathedral stood upon the plot of previous structures called cathedrals, and was indeed only called a cathedral because of that Masonic legacy. There were cellars down there, deep under the foundations, the basements of previous incarnations.
cisterns buried under the sub-fabric of later builds. Some said if you could trace your way down through the dark, you'd reach the centre of the earth and the catacombs of old Frank. One of Mirza's contacts, and he as usual had a network of well-paid informers watching the traffic of artefacts and relics throughout the entire Lutetian city node area, had reported that a gang of labourers had excavated the entrance to a drainage sump while reclaiming old stone. Some silver amulets and a ring scooped from the sump had been enough to convince the contact that the area was worth a look, and worth the fee that the conservators would have to pay the gang to reveal the precise location. Hauser had been mistrustful from the start. The labourers, all local, were big men caked in black mud from street work. All of them showed signs of atomic mutation, a trait common in the slum. Hauser immediately felt threatened by them, physically intimidated, the way he had been by the bigger, older boys back at Rector Juve's commune. He was no fighter. Confrontation, especially physical confrontation, made him lock up and freeze. The slum district was a maze. Nothing identifiable remained of the planned city that had once occupied the area. The streets had corroded into sub-streets and underruns, alleys and cul-de-sacs, all of them dark and thick with filth, none of them charted or named. Children played in the piles of trash, and the sounds of wailing babies and arguing adults echoed down from the tenement levels rising above them. Washing lines were strung from building to building, like the canopy of a dingy man-made jungle. It was shadowy and airless. The labourers led them into the alley maze. It seemed an unnecessarily circuitous route to Hauser, and he said so to Mirza, who told him to hush. After walking for about 20 minutes, the labourers turned and told Mirza it was time to pay them the agreed fee. The leader of the gang happened to add that what he meant by the agreed fee was significantly higher than anything Mirza had discussed with the team. Hauser realised they were in trouble. He realised it was all simply a trap designed to extort, and that its most likely consequences would be a beating or a kidnapping. It was going to cost the conservatory programme. It was going to cost them in medical fees, or ransom, or simply excess payoffs. It might even cost lives. He felt outrage. He felt stupid that he'd allowed Mirza to walk them into another less than brilliant situation.
"This is no time to feel choleric!"
Mirza shouted. The gang was closing in on them, surly, barking threats. Some had shovels or picks.
"Run!"
Mirza yelled. Hauser recognised that running was the only sensible course of action, but the physical threat had finally eclipsed his outrage, and intimidation had glued him to the spot. One of the labourers stepped towards him, spitting curses through buckled brown teeth, shaking a fist with kielbasser knuckles. Hauser tried to force his feet to work. Mirza grabbed his arm so hard it hurt and yanked him backwards.
"Come on! Come on, Cass!"
Hauser started to stumble, his legs beginning to move. The labourer was reaching for them. Hauser realised the labourer had drawn a gun, some kind of pistol. Dragging Hauser after him, Mirza looked over his shoulder and yelled something at the labourer, a single word or sound. There was an odd pulse, a pop, like the equalisation of air at the skin of an environment bubble. The labourer yelled and fell backwards, writhing. They ran, side by side, Mirza still gripping his arm.
"What did you do?"
Hauser yelled.
"What did you do? What did you say to him?"
Mirza couldn't answer. There was blood drooling from his mouth. Chinstrap's fingers dug into his arm like hooks. Scared, Hauser shoved. He just shoved to lurch the man away, so he could walk on, get past them, leave them behind. Chinstrap hit the side of the pile of rubber-sleeved crates on the back of the track. He was airborne and travelling backwards. His spine and shoulders took the first impact, and his skull cracked back across the top of the uppermost crate. Then he plunged forwards and hit the ground flat on his face, loose as a sack of stones. His face just slapped into the gritty ice, shattering his plastic rebreather. While Chinstrap was still in the air, one of his men swung a punch at the back of Hauser's head. The punch seemed to Hauser to be ridiculously telegraphed, as if the man was trying to be sporting and give him a chance. He put his hand up to stop the fist from hitting his face and caught it in his palm. There was a little shock. He felt finger bones break and knuckles detonate, and none of them were his. The third man decided to kill Hauser and made an effort to insert a heavy cast-iron crate spanner into Hauser's skull. Once again, however, he appeared to be doing this in a delicate fashion, like an over-emphatic stage punch that goes wide of the mark but looks good from the audience. Hauser didn't want the spanner to come anywhere near him. He swung out his left hand in an impulsive, flinching gesture to brush the man's arm away. The man screamed. He appeared to have developed a second elbow halfway down his forearm. The skin of his arm folded there like an empty sock. He fell over, the spanner bouncing solidly off the ice. The other men fled. Bear was waiting for him at the foot of a Stormbird ramp.
"You're late," he said.
Hauser handed the Homer back to him.
"I'm here now."
"We would have left without you if you'd been much longer."
"I'm sure you would."
"You smell of blood," said Bear.
"Yes, I do," said Hauser. He looked at Bear. "Why didn't you tell me how thoroughly you'd rebuilt me?" he asked.